Chapter 10 Korhal, the planet of his birth. Until he set foot on it once again, Arcturus hadn't realized how much he'd missed the place. Stepping from the orbital flyer that had brought him from the John Lomas, Arcturus followed the crowds making their way to the starport's exit. Given the anti-Confederate unrest the UNN was reporting on Korhal, Arcturus had packed his uniform into his suit bag, but his CMC ident tags were hung around his neck to ease his passage through the security checkpoints. Under normal circumstances, his tags should have allowed him to pass through with the bare minimum of effort, but it took a frustrating 2 hours to travel from the flyer to the arrivals lounge, the culmination of a several-day journey from Tirador 9 and Juliana. Their parting had been emotional and heartbreaking, for her, at least. When dawn's light had shone through the polarized glass of his hotel window, Arcturus woke with the bitter taste of regret in his mouth. Looking at the sleeping form of Juliana, perfectly outlined by the tousled sheets, he had felt nothing but a profound sense of irritation at his giving in to passion and letting emotion cloud his judgment. Yes, he had wanted to take Juliana to his bed, and had gone to some effort to do so, but now that the deed was done, he felt a curious regret. Perhaps the previous night's atrocity had touched him more deeply than he had thought, but lying in the half-light of morning, he felt a sense of closure, and yet an awareness of new beginnings. It was a curious sensation. He had slipped silently from the bed and dressed, then gathered his belongings. Before he could leave, Juliana had woken and smiled. He had stayed long enough to share some breakfast before making his escape, promising that they would see each other soon. She had cried at the thought of his leaving, and he had held her for an appropriate length of time before prizing himself from her clinging embrace. And with that, he had left her. Arcturus wasn't sure exactly what he now thought of Juliana Pasteur. On the one hand, she was a beautiful woman. But on the other, if he was honest, she had been nothing more than an exercise in satisfying his own vanity. Though it had taken him longer than he would have expected, he had gotten everything he wanted from her, and she was therefore of little further interest to him. Of course, her interest in him was undimmed, but that was a problem for another day. Putting Juliana Pasteur from his mind, Arcturus had boarded the John Lomas and made his way to Korhal. As he strode toward the arrivals lounge, he saw armed patrols of Confederate militia at every step, groups of hard-eyed men and women scanning the crowds for any potential threat. Have things really gotten that bad? There had been a few reports on the UNN of the troubles on Korhal, riots, ambushes, and the occasional bombing, but the media had played these down as isolated incidents perpetrated by lone madmen. Now, here on the ground of Korhal, Arcturus wasn't so sure. "My father's been busy," he whispered to himself. The doors to the arrivals lounge opened, and he emerged into a crowded concourse of eager faces, men and women and children awaiting reunions with loved ones. Arcturus hefted his suit bag onto his shoulder and scanned the gathered people, looking for a familiar face. When he finally saw one, it certainly wasn't one he'd expected.
"Welcome back," said Achtenfeld, taking Arcturus's bag.
"Failed?" said Arcturus by way of a greeting.
"Well, my mother and father and Dorothy." "They're down the coast," said Feld, "at the summer villa."
"And they couldn't come themselves?"
"Not safely."
Arcturus sighed. He shouldn't have been surprised. But he had held to a faint hope that his parents might have bothered to come and greet the prodigal son back to the family heartland. He saw Feld sizing him up with a critical eye.
"What?"
You've changed, noted Feld. Something about you is different.
What do you mean?
I don't know exactly, but you look better for it. That's for sure.
I'm so glad you think so.
Feld nodded wearily at Arcturus's sarcasm.
Okay, then. Let's get to the ground car.
From the bedroom he shared with his wife, Angus watched the silver ground car as it made its way along the road toward the summer villa, a heavy feeling lurking in the pit of his stomach. It had been 2 years since he had seen his son, and the emotions of the day when Catherine had tearfully told him that Arcturus had joined the Marines were as strong as ever. Angus struggled to hold his temper as he thought back to Dorothy's tears that same evening, knowing that Catherine had pinned her hopes on a family reconciliation tonight. Catherine's happiness was the most important thing in the world to Angus Mengsk, and he just hoped he could get through this evening without barking at his errant son.
"Are you ready?" said Catherine from the bedroom door. "He's almost here."
Angus turned and gave his wife a smile.
"I don't know if I'm ready, but let's go anyway."
"Please, Angus," said Catherine, "you promised."
"I know,"
he said, reaching out to her. She came into the room and took his hands.
"But I can't forget how he hurt you, how he hurt all of us."
"You have to. Arcturus is our son."
"But joining the military,"
said Angus, shaking his head.
"Of all the ways he could have chosen to disappoint me."
"Stop it,"
said Catherine in a tone that warned Angus he was on thin ice.
"He is our son, and he will be welcome here no matter what. Do you understand me?"
"Of course, dear, but the boy infuriates me."
Catherine smiled.
"No one gets under our skin quite like the people we love."
"Especially family," said Angus.
"Especially family,"
agreed Catherine.
"They wouldn't get to us so much if we didn't love them."
"I suppose," said Angus. "Where's Dorothy?"
"She's in her room."
"Is she coming down?"
"Not yet," said Catherine sadly. "She's just curled up with Pontius and says she doesn't want to see Arcturus."
"I don't see why she gets out of this, and I can't,"
grumbled Angus.
"Are you seriously pouting because you're having to do something a 6-year-old won't?"
"No."
"Shame on you, Angus Mengsk," said Catherine. "Now, come on, let's go downstairs."
"Fine,"
said Angus, taking a deep breath and straightening his jacket.
"How do I look?"
"Like a father," said Catherine.
The ground car drew to a halt within the villa's courtyard, and Arcturus got out in time to see his mother and father emerge onto the steps before the front door. His father was dressed in an immaculate, severely cut suit of ash gray, with the wolf head emblem on the breast pocket, while his mother wore an elegant dress of cornflower blue. The air was fresh, with the tang of salt water, and a pleasing chill blew in off the ocean. As 5 armed guards stood in the shadows of the courtyard, Arcturus stood straight and with his shoulders back, trying to read the expressions on his parents' faces. His mother smiled warmly, and Arcturus thought he detected a faint hint of welcome, even in his father's stern features. Acton Feld moved past him with his suit bag, and Arcturus followed him. As he reached the bottom of the steps, his mother came down and embraced him, all her thoughts of reserve forgotten as tears spilled down her cheeks.
"Oh, Arcturus,"
she wept,
"it's so good to have you home. We've missed you so much."
He returned his mother's embrace, feeling a powerful, forgiving sense of return. He surrendered to it, and felt years of bitterness begin to wash away at the simple sincerity of his mother's welcoming love. Eventually his mother released him, and he found himself face to face with his father.
The moment stretched, and the warmth of the previous welcome faded like a distant memory. At last his father extended his hand.
"Good to see you, son," said Angus. Arcturus smiled, though it was an effort.
"And you, father?" They shook hands stiffly, but Arcturus could discern that, despite himself, his father was actually pleased to see him.
"You've changed," said Angus.
"So Fael tells me," replied Arcturus, "though he seems unable to say how."
"It's your eyes. You've gotten older. You've done things that have aged you."
"Is that a good thing?"
"I don't know yet," said his father, releasing his hand.
Arcturus saw his mother narrow her eyes and turn to her. "Where's Dorothy?" "She's upstairs," said his mother. Sleep. It seemed a shame to wake her." Arcturus caught the hesitation in her reply and said, "Come on, mother. Where is she really?" "She's upstairs," repeated Catherine. "She's just... well, she's still angry with you. After 2 years..."
"People can't hold grudges for longer than that," said his father.
Arcturus nodded. "So I gather she's in her room?" "Yes," said Catherine. "But maybe you should let her come down in her own time, dear." "I don't think so," said Arcturus. "If there's one thing I've learned, it's that it's almost always best to tackle a problem head on."
"The Marines teach you that?" said Angus.
"No, I learned that from you," said Arcturus, sweeping past his parents and into the villa. The entrance hall was exactly as he remembered it, with its checkerboard patterned floor, dark paneling, and gold-framed portraits. His mother's objet d'art still stood on their white marble columns, and no sooner was he across the threshold than 100 memories from his childhood returned. He stood in the warm hallway, letting the smells of the house wash over him in a sustained assault on his senses. The wax rubbed into the wooden floors, the aroma of slowly cooking dinner, the polish used on the silverware. Arcturus could hear the bustle of staff in the kitchens, the creak and groan of an aged house warmed by the sun, and the hum of the generator room deep in the basement. The house spoke to him in a language of the senses, a combination of 1,000 different sights, sounds, and smells, but they all blended into one simple feeling. He was home. How many soldiers fantasized about home? All of them. Even the ones with nothing much to look forward to at the end of their term of service. Home was an idealized notion to most military men, but here, standing in the house in which he'd spent every summer growing up, Arcturus knew that this was no fantasy. Arcturus climbed the stairs, avoiding the creaking ones, as he had always done as a child, and made his way toward Dorothy's room. He smiled as he saw that her door was still covered with colorful letters. He knocked lightly on the door, 3 slow knocks, followed by 3 quick ones, the secret code they'd used when she was little more than a toddler.
"Go away!"
came a voice from beyond the door.
"Little Dot, it's me," he said. "Arcturus."
"I know."
Realizing he would get nowhere like this, Arcturus pushed open the door and went in. Inside, he saw that Dorothy's room had changed since the last time he'd seen it. It was still strewn with toys, but there was an order to them now, a hierarchy that had Dorothy clearly at the top. His sister lay on her back in the center of her bed, Pontius the pony held tightly across her chest. The old pony was looking a little threadbare, but Dorothy plainly wasn't about to let that stop her from hanging on to him.
"Hello, little Dot," he said. "I'm back home."
"No one calls me that anymore,"
said Dorothy. I'm not a baby anymore.
Arcturus crossed the room to stand at the side of her bed, observing that Dorothy had indeed grown since he had seen her last. She had blossomed into a pretty little girl with the distinctive high cheekbones of her mother and the thunderous brow of her father. She wore a smart dress, and her hair was plaited in two pigtails. Even lying down, she looked every inch the Manx she was. He smiled.
Okay, so what do they call you now, then?
Dorothy, silly,
she said, as if it was the most obvious thing in the world, which, he had to admit, it probably was.
What else would they call me?
Sigh, yes, should have thought about that, he said, sitting on the edge of her bed.
I don't want to talk to you,
said Dorothy, rolling away from him and onto her side.
Well, that's too bad, said Arcturus. I suppose I'll have to keep the present I was going to give you. Maybe I'll give it to some poor children.
I don't care, she said. I don't want it anyway.
That's a shame. It was a really nice present.
I told you I don't care, said Dorothy,
and Arcturus saw he wasn't going to win her over with simple appeals to a child's greed. As always, he'd have to go for the emotional blackmail.
I wrote to you every day, but you didn't write back, he said. I missed you. I really missed you, little sister.
Then why did you leave me?
She cried, rolling over to face him and hurling Pontius at him. The stuffed pony bounced to the floor, and Arcturus leaned back as Dorothy rose to her knees and hit him over and over on the chest with tiny fists.
You went away and left me without saying goodbye,
she sobbed. He let her vent her frustrations on him without protest, and when she was done, he put his arms around her and held her tightly.
I know I did, and I'm sorry. I never meant to leave you like that.
Then why did you go? I never saw you to say goodbye.
I had to go, he said. I couldn't stay here.
Why, because of Daddy?
No, it was because of me. I had to go and do something for me. Something that wasn't some idea or plan of his. Joining up was my way of doing that.
You could have died, cried Dorothy. Soldiers get shot at and blown up all the time. I see it on the news every day. Even though Mommy and Daddy don't like me watching it, I kept looking for you. I kept watching the news and wondering if you'd been killed.
Arcturus held his sister close as she cried, not having thought about what she must have gone through, wondering if he was alive or dead. His mother and father would no doubt have assured her that he was alive and well. But what force could compete with the imagination of a 6-year-old?
I'm sorry, Dorothy. I really am. I never meant for you to worry about me. I'm your big brother. I can look after myself.
And who's going to look after me? You're my big brother, and you promised you wouldn't let anything happen to me. But then you went away, and anything could have happened to me. Those bad men could have come back and shot Mommy and Daddy and me, or a bomb could have blown us all up, or those rebels with guns could have shot us because Daddy has so much money.
The words poured from Dorothy in a rush, and Arcturus felt his heart go out to her. Dorothy was a confident, articulate little girl, and a Manx to boot. But she was still only 6. He realized he had forgotten that.
Nothing like that could happen, he said as forcefully as he could. Daddy pays Acton Feld too much money for anything to happen to you. And now that I'm a soldier, I have a big gun and a whole platoon of Marines who will protect you, I promise. She squeezed him tightly, and he smiled, knowing he had won her around.
I missed you, she said. I cried for a week when you left.
I'm sorry, he said once more. But I'm back for a while, and I promise I won't go away this time without telling you first.
Mummy really missed you. I heard her crying, too. Daddy missed you as well. He never said it, but I could tell that he did.
Arcturus lifted her face from his shoulder. I love you, Dorothy, and I always will.
I love you, too, she sniffed. And it's okay. You can call me Lil Dot if you want.
Thanks.
You're welcome,
said Dorothy.
Now where's my present?
Dinner was often a lavish affair in the Manx household, held in the oak-paneled dining room and comprising several courses, a wide selection of wines, and a grand fire burning in the iron grate. Angus Manx sat at one end of the long rosewood dining room table, with Catherine at the other end, and Arcturus in the middle to his father's right. Dorothy sat opposite Arcturus and sipped from a cup of fresh apple juice. As was customary, Pontius sat at the table next to her, with his own place setting. Arcturus and his father had shared a glass of port before dinner, a breach of etiquette under normal circumstances, but Angus had never liked doing things by the book, a trait he seemed not to know that he had passed on to his son. Angus had drunk a white port, but Arcturus found he preferred a darker, ruby port, and they had sat on either side of the chessboard as his mother cleaned Dorothy up for dinner. The carved pieces were arrayed for battle, but neither man was in the mood for a game. Arcturus had defeated his father when he was 11, and they had never played since. They spoke guardedly, with Arcturus unsurprised to discover that his father was just as vocal as ever in his condemnation of the Confederacy. The special target of Angus's ire these days was the fact that the construction of the new Core Hall Assembly Forum had been abandoned, and the site bulldozed for some overpriced housing development. Of course, the demolition contract had been awarded to a company owned by one of the old families, the Tigors, and the new building contract awarded to a firm owned by a distant nephew of Andrea Tigor. Times changed, but corruption, it seemed, stayed the same. Arcturus drained the last of his port as his mother and Dorothy entered the dining room. His father smiled at the sight of his daughter, and Arcturus was reminded that, above all the politicking, the railing against the Confederacy and his complicity in terrorist activities, Angus Mengsk was still a loving father. The family seated themselves at the table, and dinner began, with the slightly strained atmosphere broken by the excited chatter of Dorothy as she spun tales of her preschool class and the many children she played with. As he watched the faces of his mother and father come to life, Arcturus realized that it must have been some time since Dorothy had opened up like this. Conversation flowed around the table, though Arcturus saw how his mother skillfully steered them all away from any contentious topics. The first course arrived, a truffle custard garnished with small slivers of pâté, and Arcturus made appreciative noises as he tasted the food. Like many wives of wealthy men, Catherine Mengsk took a keen interest in the running of the household, and the majority of the dishes served were ones of her own creation, using local ingredients and incorporating her family's favorite flavors.
Small glasses of a light, sparkling wine were served with the first course, which was swiftly followed by a mushroom risotto with baby arugula, manchego cheese, and a lemon parsley sauce. Used to living on a diet of ration packs and mess hall dishes, Arcturus found himself struggling with the sheer volume of food. But a lavender sorbet cleared his palate in time for a roasted rosemary pork loin brochette with tomato port sauce and Gruyere cheese grits. Finally, a shallow bowl of sweet potato pound cake with a blood orange and bourbon glaze and nutmeg whipped cream was served, and after one portion, Arcturus knew he could not eat another mouthful. Coffees were served, and a small bowl of mints placed in the center of the table.
"Mother, that was a triumph," said Arcturus as the last of the plates were cleaned.
"Absolutely," agreed Angus,
and Catherine smiled to see her son and husband in agreement for once.
"I'm glad you approve," said Catherine. "I planned the menu especially for tonight. I wanted us to have a proper family dinner together. It's been too long since we all sat around a table and just enjoyed each other's company. Don't you agree?"
Arcturus hid a smile at his mother's seemingly innocent question, recognizing an iron fist in a velvet glove when he saw one.
"Of course," said Angus, hearing the same thing,
and Arcturus looked over at his father to share a knowing look. The ease of the glance and the natural way he'd looked over surprised him as much as it appeared to surprise his father.
"I've missed this," said Arcturus. "It's good to be back home."
"I'm glad you're back," said Dorothy,
and the matter was settled. With the dinner cleared away, Catherine hustled Dorothy off to bed, though not before she had secured hugs and kisses for both herself and Pontius from her father and brother. With the women of the household away, the friction that had fled upon their arrival snuck back into the room like a malignant shadow.
"A glass of port,"
said Angus, and Arcturus nodded.
"Ruby for me," he said.
Angus poured two glasses of port and handed one to Arcturus. They stood in silence for a moment, and Arcturus saw his father struggling to find the right words. With Catherine present, conversation had been light and inconsequential, but without her calming influence, the tension between these two alpha males was resurgent.
"I'm glad you came, son," said Angus at last. "Your mother went to a lot of trouble tonight, and Dorothy, well, you can see how pleased she is to see you."
"And you?" asked Arcturus. "Are you pleased to see me?"
"Of course. You know I am. You are my son."
"I know, but the last time we spoke wasn't exactly friendly."
"You had just gone and joined the Marines," said Angus. "My son, the Confederate Marine, what did you expect?"
"I expected you to respect my damn decision," snapped Arcturus.
Angus sighed and took a sip of his port.
"Are you trying to pick a fight, Arcturus?"
"No," said Arcturus. "I'm really not. It's just, well, we've never seen eye to eye on lots of things, have we?"
"Not that I can recall, no."
"Exactly. And back when I was living on Coal Hall, every time you looked at me, it was like you were trying to find faults with whatever I did. Nothing I did was ever good enough for you."
"That's ridiculous," said Angus. "I just wanted the best for you. You see that, surely?"
"The best for me? Are you sure? Or did you want the best for you? What I wanted didn't seem important. All you cared about was whether I was a fit successor to you.
Angus poured himself another glass of port, using the time to curb an angry outburst. Arcturus knew that goading his father could only end one way, but couldn't stop the words from flowing. 2 years of pent-up feelings were now coming out, and he couldn't stop them.
Arcturus, you are my son, and I have only ever wanted the best for you. You are intelligent and can be the best at whatever you want to be. But to waste your life fighting for a tyrannical, corrupt regime that seeks to take control of everything in the galaxy is just stupid.
So now I'm stupid.
That's not what I said. You're not even listening to me. You're hearing what you want to hear, so you can prolong this argument.
Arcturus knew his father was speaking the truth, but the memory of Private Shaw leapt to the forefront of his mind. The image of the boy's torn-up body lying in a pool of blood on the floor of a bar on Terrador 9 fogging his usual clear-headedness.
No, that's not it at all, said Arcturus.
Then what is it? Demanded Angus. Because I'd really like to know.
It's what you're doing on Core Hall, said Arcturus. The bombings and the riots. You and Feld and your band of revolutionaries are still fanning the flames of hatred here, aren't you?
Keep your damn voice down, hissed Angus.
Why, afraid this Confederate Marine might report you to the authorities?
You wouldn't, said Angus, genuinely horrified at the notion of his son turning on him.
No, of course not. But I've seen the reality of what people like you are doing, said Arcturus. I saw the bodies and the blood on Terrador 9, and I heard the screaming. You can justify what you're doing with talk of corruption and with clever wordplay, but I've seen what's left behind. I saw men shot down without mercy, and God knows how many innocent bystanders were caught in the crossfire. If that's what you're doing, then I want no part of it.
The attack on Terrador 9 was nothing to do with me, Arcturus, said Angus, taking a step toward him. I swear it. We only attack military targets, combatants, because we're in a war. Make no mistake about that.
Military targets, said Angus,
pulling his marine ident tags from beneath his shirt.
What do you think these make me? Tell me, would you bomb me or authorize some other attack that might get me killed if it was part of your grand plan?
Of course not, Arcturus. Why are you doing this? Your mother wanted for us to become a family again tonight. Don't ruin it for her.
It was a mistake coming here,
said Arcturus, putting down his glass and turning toward the door.
I should go.
No, Arcturus, please stay,
said Angus, following him and taking his arm.
For your mother and Dorothy, if not for me.
Arcturus turned to face his father.
I'll be gone in the morning.
Far from the glowing jewel that was Sterling, the darkness of the sky was absolute. Arcturus sat on the walnut bench his father had built at the end of the path from the villa, watching the sea explode against the cliffs below in silver cascades. A bronze plaque in the middle of the bench was carved with a memorial inscription to Arcturus's grandfather, Augustus. But the words had been obscured by a green skim of corrosion and could no longer be read. He sat and looked up at the stars, wondering which ones he would travel to next. The possibilities were endless, and certainly he was likely to see a great many different worlds with the Marines, and once he was tired of military life, a point he knew was fast approaching, he would muster out and head to the rim, just far enough out to be free. Arcturus felt a vibration in his pocket and took out his phone. He waited until the tone had stopped and then flipped it open. Another message from Juliana. That made 15 since he had arrived on Korhal. He sighed and replaced the phone in his pocket as he heard footsteps behind him.
"Mind if I join you?" said Achtenfeld.
"If you're here to convince me to stay, then you're wasting your breath."
"I'm not. I know it's a lost cause trying to convince you of anything."
Arcturus nodded and gestured toward the bench.
"Then sit down."
The two men sat in silence for a while, content to simply enjoy the majesty of the view. Farther out to sea, the ocean was like a black mirror, vast and reflecting the stars above in wavering pinpoints. Occasional silver streaks flashed across the sky. Arcturus liked to believe they were shooting stars, though he knew they were simply starships hitting the atmosphere.
"You'll regret this, you know," said Feld eventually.
"What?"
"Leaving like this. You don't know what's going to happen in the future, so do you really want this to be the last memory you have of your folks?"
"You're being melodramatic, Feld," said Arcturus. "It doesn't suit you."
"I'm not, Arcturus. Trust me. What's happening on Korhal is more dangerous than you know. The Confederacy is running scared here, and anyone who's seen combat knows that's when the enemy is at its most dangerous. They'll try anything, and as good as I am, I can't guarantee anyone's safety in the face of that kind of desperation."
"Are things really that bad?"
Feld simply nodded and said,
"You can never go home. Isn't that what they say?"
"Who?"
"They. Them. Whoever. It doesn't matter."
"What does it mean?"
"When you live here on Korhal, you think it's the center of the world, and you believe nothing will ever change. Then you leave and don't come back for a few years, and when you come back, everything's changed. The connection's broken. What you came to find isn't there, and what was yours is gone. You'll have to go away for a long time before you can come back and find your people. The world where you were born. But now, for you, it's not possible. You're not ready to come back to Korhal. Or maybe she's not ready for you. I don't know."
"Since when did you become a philosopher, Feld?"
"I've been around," said Feld. "And I picked up a few things along the way. Just don't do anything rash, okay? If you're going to leave, fine, leave, but say goodbye first. Don't leave like last time."
"Don't burn any bridges? Is that what you're saying?"
"Yeah, I guess it is," agreed Feld. "Say your goodbyes and then go. And don't come back until you're ready to come back. Make a clean break until then."
Arcturus's phone trilled again, and he knew who it was without even looking. Juliana.
"A clean break, you say?"
"Yeah.
I think you might be right, Feld."
Chapter 11. Arcturus leaned his head back against the plyboard wall of the office and closed his eyes, letting the hum of the air heaters and the clicking sound of Lieutenant Sestoda's typing lull him into a semi-doze. It would be at least another half hour before he was admitted into Commander Foley's office, anyway. Appointments with Brantigan Foley were always late. The bullish commanding officer of the 33rd Ground Assault Division of the Confederate Marine Corps kept very much to his own schedule and no one else's. Lieutenant Lars Sestoda, the adjutant tasked with keeping track of the commander's appointments, was a waspish and punctilious man who, at first glance, seemed an unlikely soldier, but who positively thrived on the minutiae of army regulations. Despite the convection heaters warming the office, Arcturus still felt the chill in the air and pulled his uniform jacket tighter. He'd need to request a new one soon. This one barely fit his broad shoulders and wide chest. The summons to Commander Foley's office in Camp Hastings had come out of the blue, as most orders did in the Marine Corps, but this one had the reek of importance to it, and thus Arcturus had arrived early, even though he knew it would be a while before the commander deigned to see him. The outer office was plain and stark. The only items of furniture, an uncomfortable couch on which Arcturus sat, a pair of iron filing cabinets that looked old and battered enough to have come from the Sarango, and the desk and chair used by Lieutenant Sestota. A few Marine recruitment posters were stuck to the wall with thumbtacks, which seemed a little redundant to Arcturus, since anyone likely to see these posters would already be in the Marine Corps. Arcturus stood and stretched. He'd been waiting for an hour and had already thumbed through a copy of Battle Flag, the magazine of the CMC. The paper version of the magazine had long since been replaced by digitome editions, and this copy had seen better days. Sestota looked up in irritation as Arcturus rose to his feet.
"Something I can do for you, Captain?" asked Sestota, as though Arcturus had violated some unwritten rule of the office.
"No," said Arcturus. "Just stretching my legs." "Do you have any idea when the commander will be available?"
"Presently."
"That's what you said 30 minutes ago."
"Then you shouldn't have needed to ask again."
Arcturus approached Sestota's desk and perched on the edge, knowing it would annoy the man. Sure enough, Sestota glared at him, but Arcturus met his stare with one of his own.
"You are aware of the etymology of your name, I presume?" asked Arcturus, picking up a stylus from the desk.
Sestota snatched it back.
"The what?"
"Etymology," repeated Arcturus slowly. "It means the origins of words and how they arrived at their current meaning. I was asking if you knew what your name means."
"It doesn't mean anything," said Sestota. "It's just a name."
"On the contrary, my dear fellow, in times past a man's name was what defined him. Many names came from a man's profession, such as Smith or Cooper, while others made reference to his disposition or appearance."
"What does that have to do with me?" "Ah,
well, you see, Sestota is a class of parasitic flatworms that live in the digestive tracts of vertebrates and absorb food predigested by their host. They're ugly creatures, little more than a body with only a rudimentary head for attachment to their host. And one of the most common complaints regarding them is the nausea they cause. Just thought you ought to know."
Arcturus got up from Sestota's desk before he could reply and moved toward the insulated window that looked out over the barren, blue-lit hinterlands of Anuru Sigma. The outlying buildings of Camp Hastings huddled beneath the cobalt sky, and beyond the defensive turrets, icy tundra spread out for hundreds of miles toward escarpments of glaciers that towered kilometers into the sky. The sealant around the glass was degrading, and the sulfurous chill of the planet's arctic temperatures stole what little heat the convectors were generating. Arcturus studied his reflection, his features rugged and handsome in the tinted glass. His cheeks were well-defined, and he now sported a neatly trimmed goatee around his full mouth. His eyes were as piercing as ever they were, though far older than any 24-year-old man's eyes should be. And his dark hair was thick and black. He smiled as he saw he was the image of his father. A younger, handsomer version of his father, of course. Though virtually every UNN broadcast was filled with images of Angus Mengsk, the madman of Korhal, they called him, it had been a long time since Arcturus had consciously thought of his father. Almost 5 years had passed since he had seen his family, and though he had not passed a single word with his father, he kept in regular touch with his mother and Dorothy. His sister had just turned 11, an age that made Arcturus feel very old indeed. It seemed like only yesterday little Dot had been born, but now her conversations over the vidphone were filled with talk of boys and parties and how she hated not being able to leave the house without an escort of soldiers. The trouble on Korhal was on the verge of getting completely out of hand, and the pundits agreed it was only a matter of time until martial law was declared. Arcturus wasn't worried for his father, who had chosen to live such a dangerous life, but he fretted constantly for his mother and sister. He had once promised Dorothy wouldn't let anything happen to her, and Feld's warning that their safety couldn't be guaranteed still echoed in his imagination. He turned as he heard a chime from Sestoda's desk and smiled at the irritated glance that ghosted across the man's features as he listened to Foley's voice through his earpiece. Sestoda looked up and said, "Commander Foley will see you now." The commanding officer of the 33rd Ground Assault Division was a short fireplug of a man, with a short temper and a quick manner that left many of his fellow soldiers floundering in his wake. His salt-and-pepper hair was kept cropped close to his skull, and his skin was tanned the color and texture of worn leather from the rays of 100 different suns. An unlit cigar was clamped between his teeth, and he chewed a wad of tobacco, a habit he'd picked up while stationed along the outer rim and never saw fit to discard when he returned to more civilized space. His uniform was immaculately pressed and decorated with enough stars to fill a decent-sized planetarium. Arcturus snapped to attention and saluted the commander, who returned the salute without looking up from the papers arranged haphazardly on his desk. Another officer, one with the rank badge of a captain pinned to his white uniform, stood at attention beside the commander. This captain was broad-shouldered and wore the power of his rank like a threat. His features were arrogant, rugged, and pugnacious. Arcturus disliked him instantly. He guessed the man was around 40, which made him old for a captain, and his physique was impressive for a man his age.
"Sit down, Captain," said Foley. "I have a job for you."
"Yes, sir," said Arcturus, taking the seat in front of Foley's desk.
"This here's Edmund Duke," said Foley, jerking a thumb in the direction of the man standing beside him. "A captain in Alpha Squadron. His outfit is heading out to the Naranda Glacier Vespine Mine, and I want Dominion Section to go with him."
Arcturus nodded. He'd heard of Alpha Squadron, who were supposedly the most efficient fighters in the Confederacy, which meant the most brutal, and whose motto was "First Group In, First Group Out." They were nicknamed the Bloodhawks, which spoke volumes for Arcturus's assessment.
"Yes, sir. What's the mission?"
"Convince the miners it'll be in their best interests to move on and leave the place to us. The Kalmorians have been busy around this system, and the brass thinks something big's in the wind, which they ain't too happy about. We're to keep a lid on things and make sure those damn pirates don't get too uppity. You know, the usual."
"The usual," said Arcturus wearily. If Foley heard his tone, he didn't comment on it, but Arcturus could see Duke bristling. "If you have Alpha Squadron, why do you need Dominion Section?"
"Orders from on high to combine some of our active squads. I'm thinking of attaching your men to Alpha, so I want Duke to carry out an evaluation in the field. Make sure everyone's up to scratch."
Arcturus was horrified at the idea of Dominion Sections coming under the command of Edmund Duke. Though he had never met the man before, he instinctively knew he was an arrogant blowhard. As he looked at Duke's smirking face, he realized he recognized him. He'd seen the same arrogant face on the UNN when its reporters covered the activities of the old families.
"Edmund Duke," he said, "as in the Tassonis Dukes?"
"The one and only," drawled Duke. "I hear most of your boys are Rimworld yokels. That the case? Only two things come from the Rimworlds, boy."
"Yes, yes, I know," interrupted Arcturus, returning his attention to his commander.
"Sir, you can't be seriously considering this. You can't put Dominion Section under this man's command." "You telling me what to do with my own division, Minsk?" asked Foley.
"No, sir," said Arcturus hurriedly, "but—"
"Just as well,"
carried on Foley, as though Arcturus hadn't spoken.
"You're a good officer, Minsk, and the men respect you. But I'll have you scrubbing latrines in a heartbeat if you try and tell me my business again. Are we clear?"
"Crystal, sir," said Minsk.
"Anyway, what do you care? You're due to muster out soon, so it doesn't matter who commands them."
"I just want to make sure my men are in good hands," said Arcturus, glaring at Duke.
"Well, that ain't your concern no more, Minsk," replied Foley. "Now get out of here and make sure your men are ready for action. Mission briefing is at 1900 and dropships are skids up at 2000.
A spiteful wind scoured the glacial slopes below the Naronda Glacier Vespine mine. Arcturus kept his helmeted head down against the force of it, his gaze firmly fixed on the blue ridge of snow ahead of him, beyond which lay the mine itself. The streaked sky above the ridge was squalid with scads of vapor and the emphysemic discoloration of poor emission control. He marched alongside Edmund Duke, the man's white armor decorated with dozens of rank badges and combat citations. It seemed that for all his bluster, Duke had seen his fair share of battle. It didn't make Arcturus like him any better, but at least he wasn't going into action alongside a rookie. 100 Marines spread out in combat formation trudged up the rugged slopes toward the ridge. 7 Goliath walkers marched in support of them, but even these hardy machines found the terrain challenging, their gyros fighting to keep them stable on the treacherous ice and snow. Vulture hover cycles zipped around the flanks, and Arcturus could just about hear the engine roar of the 2 supporting Wraith fighters over the howling winds as they circled above. The dropships that had ferried them from Camp Hastings had been forced to debust them a kilometer back, the craft's poor aerodynamics unable to cope with the high winds and low visibility.
"Hell of a force, eh, Minsk?"
said Duke over the comms between their helmets.
"You ever seen such righteous display of Confederate might?"
"It's impressive," agreed Arcturus. "It's been some time since I've seen this amount of firepower gathered in one place."
"Yeah, just wish I had me one of them siege tanks."
"The ice here is too unstable," said Arcturus. "In all likelihood, we would have lost it down a crevasse before we traveled half a kilometer."
"I know that, but with one of those babies we could have just scared these damn miners out like the yellow bellies you ran into in Taronga Canyon."
"You heard about that?"
"Sure did. You handled it pretty well, but you were damn lucky those miners didn't have a pair of balls between the whole lot of them."
Arcturus shook his head at Duke's simplistic reading of the engagement, but didn't reply as his fellow captain continued.
"If I had my way, we'd just be chasing these dirt grubbers away at the end of the volley of impaler fire, and that'd be the end of it."
"If a trifle heavy-handed," said Arcturus.
"Heavy-handed? Who do you think you work for, the Boy Scouts? This here's the Confederate Marine Corps, and if you're ever gonna make something of yourself, Minsk, you gonna need to get some ruthlessness in you."
"Is that a fact?" "Damn straight," said Duke, slapping a heavy gauntlet on the side of his gauze rifle. "Ain't no messing with one of these babies." "Tell me something, Edmund. You don't mind if I call you Edmund, do you? How is it that a scion of one of the old families ends up out here pushing miners around as a captain? With your family's influence and the amount of combat it looks like you've seen, I'd have thought they'd have made you a general by now." Duke stopped and turned to face him, and Arcturus could see the cold anger in his eyes. "Yeah, I do mind you calling me Edmund. And why I'm here is none of your goddamn business. We got our orders, and I'm a man who obeys orders. So why don't you shut the hell up and follow yours?" Arcturus smiled as Duke stomped off toward the ridge, letting the man get a goodly distance ahead before embarking himself. "Jay, Captain, I reckon you done annoyed the big fella," said Chuck Horner, coming alongside him. "What do you say to him?"
"Nothing much," said Arcturus. "How's the section, Lieutenant?"
"They're okay," answered Horner. "DeSanto's grumbling about the mission. Yancey won't shut up. Chun Leung's bitching about what this weather's doing to Mayumi. And Toby ain't said squat since we touched down, so business as usual, I guess."
Chuck Horner had served as Arcturus's unofficial second-in-command since the fighting on Sanyan, a position he had fulfilled admirably, eventually earning himself a commission to lieutenant. Arcturus turned and looked behind him, the blue armored shapes of Dominion Section marching a discreet distance away from the Marines of Alpha Squadron. Their walks and posture were as familiar to him as his own, and he nodded to each of them as they caught up.
"What's the story, Captain?" said Yancey. "We there yet?"
"Nearly," said Arcturus, pointing to the ridge 100 meters or so above them. "Just beyond there."
"This is some weather, huh?" said Chun Leung, holding his rifle protectively across his chest to protect it from the worst of the wind.
The man's visor was fogged, and the plates of his armor were stained with pollutants, yet somehow his weapon was still pristine.
"We saw worse than this on Paragos, remember?" said Yancey.
"I'm trying to forget that one," grumbled Chun Leung. "Took months to get all that grit out of Mayumi's breech."
"This gonna be more of the same?" asked Dia
DeSanto. Arcturus didn't have to ask what she meant. Most of their ops in the last few years had involved securing mines or frontier exploration sites from Kelmorian prospectors. Either that, or providing heavily armed backup to local enforcers. Riots and thousand-strong protests were flaring up throughout the Confederacy with ever more regularity, and you couldn't watch the UNN without some report coming on about a disaffected populace attacking police or marching beneath waving banners. Of course, these were downplayed as a few malcontents, but Dominion Section's experiences and Arcturus's last visit to Korhal told him that things were far worse than anyone suspected. The Confederacy was rotting from the inside out, and the powers that be were holding on by their fingertips. "More the same," said Arcturus, as a sudden shiver ran along the length of his spine. "You know, I rather think it won't be."
"What do you mean, Captain?"
"I have a feeling that Duke isn't playing with a full deck," said Arcturus, disregarding the military protocol of not criticizing fellow officers to lower-ranked soldiers.
"You think he's dangerous?"
asked Chuck Horner.
"Very much so, Charles," said Arcturus. "I'm just not sure whom he's dangerous to."
Naronda Glacier itself towered over them, a solid escarpment of blue ice on the opposite edge of a shallow, bold meteor crater gouged into the ice thousands of years ago.
The crater's ridge curved away to either side, and its far edge was over 3 kilometers away. The cliff of the glacier reached thousands of meters into the air, like the dwelling place of gods from ancient legend. In the center of the shallow bowl, a dark fault line split the ice, and the tendrils of a yellowish-green vapor issued from all along its length. A giant metallic refinery structure of huge pipes, towering collection vats, and flaring exhausts squatted at the center of the crater like a giant oil-stained spider, surrounded by a host of prefabricated storage sheds and rough-looking living compounds. Men in hostile environment suits went about their business below, oblivious to the Marines poised to march in and take their livelihood, and huge trucks with spiked wheels crunched over the ice as they loaded up with containers of the precious gas. It looked as though the place had been built in the midst of what had once been a ruined city, with jagged spires of dark, crystal-veined stone clustered around the more recently built constructions. The architecture of these ruins was a mystery, but there was something about them that looked oddly out of scale with the humans toiling in their shadow. Brantigan Foley's Marines lay in the lee of the crater's edge, looking down into the enormous crater. The Goliaths were hunkered down behind them, and the vultures did looping circuits of the snow farther back. High overhead, the wraiths flew figure-eight patterns, lost in the clouds, their engines inaudible. A thrumming vibration was carried through the ice toward the waiting Marines, and Arcturus couldn't help but admire the skill with which the builders of this complex had managed to anchor the refinery over the Vespine geyser. How had they overcome the problem of the shifting ice and the need to keep the collection head stable? Arcturus couldn't wait to get in and examine the complex.
"Hell, they must have to drill down a ways to get any Vespine out of there," said Chuck Horner.
"Indeed they do," said Arcturus. "According to the briefing, the Vespine is nearly 30 kilometers beneath the ice."
"Man, that's deep," said DeSanto. "Surely there must be easier places to mine."
"Undoubtedly. But this is an uncommonly large underground geyser," said Arcturus. "And even though it's contaminated with some very noxious chemicals from beneath the ice, it's so vast that it's still worth all the extra effort and danger to get it out."
"Danger?" asked Yancey. "What danger? Aside from drilling over a dirty great crevasse, I mean."
"Look at the color of the gas coming from the extractors," said Arcturus. "You see how it has a yellowish tinge?"
"Yeah?"
"That's hydrogen sulfide, a very toxic and flammable gas. Mix it with Vespine and you have a highly unstable compound indeed."
"So this place is like one big damn bomb?" asked Dia DeSanto.
"Potentially," agreed Arcturus.
"Great," said DeSanto. "This just gets better and better."
Leaving his Marines to gripe about the danger of this current mission, Arcturus returned his attention to the target below. The ground was open and inviting, easy to walk over, but with precious little cover, and to reach the central refinery itself, the Marines would have to negotiate the tangle of abandoned maintenance sheds and sagging storage hangars. From the flaring exhaust gases, it was clear the facility was in use. But there seemed precious little activity for so large a refinery. It was almost as though the few workers in view were going through the motions. Something about this whole setup rang false to Arcturus. But before he could give the matter any further thought, Edmund Duke ran over in a crouch and dropped to his knees beside Arcturus.
"Your men ready, Minsk?" demanded Duke.
"We are," confirmed Arcturus. "How do you want to do this?" It galled him to defer to Duke's authority, but Commander Foley had been quite clear as to who held the reins of command in this operation. Duke looked at him as though he'd just asked something stupid.
How the hell do you think I want to do it? We go straight toward them and shoot anyone who gets in our way. I'll take most of the men out front with the vultures and five of the Goliaths. You and your men follow with what's left. Captain Duke, said Arcturus, giving Duke his full title as a salve to the man's ego. That seems a little heavy-handed. We don't know what's down there, and I have just finished telling my soldiers that the gases collecting there are extremely dangerous. We have to be careful here. Careful, my ass, said Duke, waving a dismissive gauntlet. Ain't nothing down there but a bunch of ditch-digging yokels, Minsk. Nothing we can't handle. Or are you telling me your boys ain't up to the job? Arcturus could feel his hackles rise at the insult to his section, but kept his temper in check, knowing that to let Duke see his anger would give him the advantage in this exchange. Not at all. Dominion section is ready for action, but we need to think this through. We can't just go in guns blazing. Why the hell not? Arcturus bellied up to the ridge and gestured to the refinery complex. Look at the number of maintenance sheds and derelict structures down there. For all we know, there could be 100 or more men waiting for us. It's a ready-made killing ground. I don't like the look of this, Duke. It smells of a trap. Minsk, the only thing I'm smelling here is cowardice, snarled Duke. Now get your goddamn men ready to move out, or I'll haul your ass in front of Commander Foley and a court-martial. Alpha Squadron formed up and moved out on Duke's order, climbing to their feet and marching over the ridge toward the refinery. Almost immediately, the workers in the mine ceased their labors and withdrew to the central complex. The Marines set a punishing stride across the ice, their powered suits allowing them to close the distance to their target at a run. Five of the Goliaths loped across the ice with Duke's men, their heavy autocannons spooled up and ready to fire. Dart-like vultures skimmed over the ice at speed, easily outpacing the Marines and moving in to circle the refinery, with their grenade launchers locked and loaded. Arcturus let Duke draw close to the refinery, before passing the order to move on to his own men and the 20 his fellow captain had deigned to leave with him. The two remaining Goliaths lumbered alongside them, one on either side of their dispersed formation, though Arcturus didn't think they'd be much use back here, where their guns couldn't engage anything for fear they'd hit their own men.
"Man, this stinks worse than that dead guy we found on Faux Wreck," said Chuck Horner.
"Stay watchful," ordered Arcturus, "and Chuck, keep in contact with the dropships."
"Sure, but if the winds don't ease back, they ain't gonna do us a whole lot of good."
"I'm aware of that. Just do it."
"Sir, yes, sir,"
said Chuck, recognizing the authoritative tone of his superior officer. Arcturus watched as Duke's men reached the outermost building in the refinery complex, passing it at a run, and spreading out to secure the target. Nothing happened, and Arcturus let out the breath he'd been holding. Vultures scooted in behind the men, and the Goliaths picked a path over the frozen gravel that served as a level surface. A wraith screamed overhead, its spiraling white contrails painting the sky and throwing up billowing ice chips as it roared over the refinery at low altitude. As the wraith pulled out of its run, Arcturus heard the metallic cough of a missile launch from within the compound. How he could have heard it so clearly over the boom of the wraith's engines and the thunder of blood in his ears, he didn't know. But he would swear on his sister's life that he'd heard it as clearly as if the missile had launched right next to him. Climbing on a glowing, fire-topped column of white smoke, the missile corkscrewed into the air from one of the dilapidated supply sheds, shreds of camo netting trailing behind it.
"Oh, no," whispered Arcturus.
At first, it seemed as though the missile could not hope to catch the wraith, but its rocket motor flared, and it surged upward at a tremendous velocity. The pilot of the aircraft saw the threat and pushed out the throttle, twisting his vehicle and heading for the open skies. The missile exploded less than 2 meters from the pilot's canopy and blew the front of the aircraft off in a bright orange fireball. Spinning wreckage tumbled down on trails of black smoke and slammed into the ice. As though the downing of the Wraith was a signal, the rattle and pop of distant small arms fire erupted from the compound ahead. Arcturus saw flashes of gunfire and heard shouted cries of alarm over the comnet in his helmet. These miners weren't going without a fight. A column of flame whooshed skyward, followed by a rattling staccato burst of secondary explosions. Armed men in green, powered combat suits poured from the supply sheds previously thought abandoned and opened fire on Duke's men. Goliaths in the same livery stomped into view, and streams of fire erupted from the weapon mounts on their arms. "Everyone forward!" shouted Arcturus, breaking into a run. "Move it!" While the enemy troops were still tangled up with Duke's Marines, they weren't pouring any fire toward Arcturus and his section, but that would soon change if they didn't close the gap. They were headed toward an olive-drab hangar-like structure with a curved roof. If they could get around it, then perhaps they could fall on the soldiers attacking Duke's men from behind. A vulture screamed around the building, chased by a rippling stream of impaler spikes fired from loopholes cut in the building Arcturus's men were heading for. The pilot jinked his machine like a snake, weaving in and out of the streams of fire, but he wouldn't last long without help.
"Goliaths!" cried Arcturus. "Engage those shooters now!"
The two armored walkers braced themselves, and their arms spun up and around. The already rotating barrels suddenly roared, and meter-long tongues of flame blasted from the ends of their weapons. Flickering sparks and torn metal exploded from the building's flanks, thousands of rounds carving the sheet metal like a whipping plasma torch. Entire strips of metal fell from the hangar, closely followed by torn-up bodies. For good measure, a salvo of missiles rippled from the shoulder mounts of the two Goliaths, streaking inside the holes their guns had torn. One after another, they exploded inside the building, and the roof boomed upward with each detonation. Flames billowed and smoke boiled from the shattered walls and roof. The vulture pilot sketched them a quick salute before pulling his hover cycle in a screaming turn and heading back to the battle.
"Minsk!" shouted Duke over the comnet. "Where the hell are you? We need help! Now, goddammit, now!"
"On our way, Duke," said Arcturus.
"Hold on!"
The fighting at the edge of the complex was fierce. Groups of armored soldiers dashing from splintered wreckage to piles of stacked steel as they fired quick bursts at one another. Arcturus chopped his hand right, the direction the vulture pilot had flown, and led his men into the complex. Impaler spikes chimed on steel and armor plates. Explosions flared, and shrapnel spanged from the walls of buildings. Thankfully, no one had been foolish enough to shoot anywhere near the refinery, but that was surely a miracle that couldn't last forever. Closer to the complex, the air was greasy and yellow, and a thick fog coiled around their ankles. Arcturus heard shouts over the comm and skidded into cover at the corner of the building. Closer in, he could see the trap that had been laid for them. The supposedly dilapidated buildings were, in fact, cunningly constructed strong points disguised to look unfinished or abandoned. An enemy Goliath strode around the corner and swiveled its gun mounts toward him.
"Down!"
he yelled and dropped into the fog. A roaring, sawing line of shells sliced the air like a fiery blade, tearing up the icy ground and sending pulverized chips of gravel flying in all directions. Even through the dampening systems in his helmet, the noise was deafening. Arcturus heard screams and the ringing hammer blows of shells tearing through armor and flesh. A body fell on top of him, most of its side chewed away. Blood squirted from the torn-up flesh, spraying Arcturus's breastplate in arcing lines. Arcturus gagged back a surge of vomit as he saw Toby Mercurio's lifeless features staring up at him through the smashed ruin of his helmet. The Goliath smashed through a pile of fallen sheet metal, another roaring torrent of shells ripping through the fog toward them. Scattered marines were firing at the armored walker, but their shots were having little effect. Arcturus pushed Mercurio's body away and rolled to his knees as another hail of explosive 30-millimeter shells reduced what little cover there was to mangled splinters of plascrete and metal shavings. A series of explosions burst against the Goliath's legs, and it stumbled, its cannon swiveling to face this